Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf.
Friday night and into Saturday, I will be in Neil Coulong's neck of the woods. Sir, always a pleasure to connect with you. You are critical to what we do.
As always, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's, what, 71 degrees here in Iowa City. The low tonight is 13. What's going on? that's like, really?
Welcome.
it's great. Yeah, I'm going to be in Minneapolis twice in a 10, 12-day span. So, got a lot going on up there. So, here we are. We get to free agency and combines. So I want to talk about the free agency part of it first, Neil. There are a lot of running backs that are right now not going to be franchise tagged. Saquon Barkley is still a little bit in the gray area right now. How do you view the running back situation based on who is available out there and what their value might be based on current payment?
I think it's the odd position in the NFL that's not exactly worth the franchise tag. And the franchise tag is really kind of top of the market. I mean, it's there's McCaffrey and there's everybody else.
Right.
I think you can put Barkley into that level, but this is a team that is currently undergoing a crisis of identity. I'm not really sure. Simply put, when you have your defensive coordinator scorching all earth on his way out of town for a team that was in the playoffs the previous year and suffered, what, 15 games without the quarterback that they just paid a bunch of money to, for the situation to have gotten that bad, that fast in New York, there's got to be a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. And maybe some of that frustration is in the fact that they did not commit fully to Barkley right away. He's a player that can do a lot of things. He's a three-down guy. He's capable of producing at the level, you know, maybe not at you know, the top of Christian McCaffrey's market, but he's one of the few guys that could be up there if given the opportunity. I don't know, though, how much money he gets on the open market, and most of it is because, unlike basically every other position in the NFL, there's a detrimental effect to running backs on the open market.
Right.
You don't see any of them getting paid in free agency. They get tagged. Sometimes here and there they get extended, or they go on the open market like a car that just drove off the lot. They're not
right.
Getting more than what they had previously. Barkley, that situation is just so odd to me, but I think that's going to set up everything else. But there are always reasonable to decent running backs who are available, and that's just simply because teams aren't utilizing enough of them, and it doesn't seem like they're struggling to find running backs throughout the draft, any round to undrafted free agency, who can come in and play a role for the team. So it's almost working backwards up, you know, in that you can fill your third running back at the absolute league minimum. They're paying them $25 an hour to fill that spot on the team. They might be up and down from the practice squad and make even less than that. The previous guy who was like that is now the second running back. Finding your first guy really doesn't seem to be as important, or certainly not prioritized to NFL teams, with the exception of a few of them, and it really depends on the type of offense they're wanting to run. Barkley, I think, represents all of it right now as far as the direction where everything is going. You look at Najee Harris's situation in Pittsburgh, that's similar. Probably the better running back, but the guy behind him is a year younger, has fewer carries, and produces at a pretty comparable level. And the price difference between the two is astronomical when you start thinking about the franchise tag or a 50-year option. Every team is going to be into that if they invest a premium pick into a running back and then give them the bulk of the carries for however long. So in my mind, it just makes more sense economically to look to find guys and run them as a group. You know, it really doesn't seem to have a ton of advantage, minus a few guys, of being one guy carrying everything. You know, Pittsburgh can certainly tell you about in the past, some of the best teams they've had recently fell short due to lack of running back depth. As ironic as that is, considering it seems everybody has running backs, Pittsburgh lost them all when they needed them, which probably led to the desire to draft Najee Harris and give him the yeoman's share of the work. That's not typical of the market at all. In fact, there might even be no more than three teams in the league that would have that kind of an issue. Overall, it's just I don't know what they're going to do. But when you have some of the veterans last season almost talking about forming their own union within the union about finding a way to raise their pay, which is just like if you're playing that card publicly, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. There's just no way that's going to happen. They aren't happy about it. They can see that they're not happy about it. And I think there's going to be something of a mini labor standoff. I'm not suggesting anyone's not going to do anything, but you're going to hear a lot of running backs not doing a whole lot in training camp, and I think there's going to be a reason for that. And teams almost can't really argue with them about it, but at the same time, they're going to end up being just mercenaries around the league. Play with one team, then another team, then another team. It's going to be really hard for them to string together guaranteed money moving forward. Basically, they're going to have to be the offensive player of the year. And I don't know how many times that's even going to happen.
Well, no. Let's look at a series of examples. Baltimore, top team AFC regular season. Gus Edwards, Super Bowl champion Kansas City, back-to-back. Isaiah Pacheco. All right. Cleveland Browns, no Nick Chubb, still made the playoffs. Now, Chubb's a terrific player, but it shows that if you have somebody functional at the position, and especially have a great quarterback, you can get there.
Yeah, the teams that you mentioned all drafted a running back with a premium pick. You know, yeah. Clyde Edwards-Helaire in Kansas City kind of fell out of favor there. They have a better weapon now, somebody that probably fits more of what they're doing, and they're okay with, you know, the difference between the two. But as soon as Edwards-Helaire is not, you know, somebody that needs to be, as soon as he gets to extension time, he's probably not going to be there. He might be able to find something else. I don't know when the last time J.K. Dobbins played was, but he has barely played in his career up to that point. And Gus Edwards has been, in my opinion, one of the better running backs in the NFL, and they get him for nothing. There's too many examples every single season of this. I really like that Ford kid in Cleveland. I'm not talking about replacing Nick Chubb, but Ford looks pretty good for who he is, for where he came from. There isn't a whole lot separating the mid-level from the top as far as the NFL is concerned nowadays, and that drives the value of that top level way down. And it's so interesting to me because it's the polar opposite. Certainly at the quarterback position, to a huge degree, the wide receiver position, edge rushers probably, you know, maybe the most distant because those guys are going to get paid for playing 12 snaps a game. And every team that you just listed has one of those players like that. You know, Jadeveon Clowney made a lot of money to not play all that much. He wasn't an everyday player, and he's on, what, his fifth team now? He's going to have another one next year, I'm sure. I'm not downplaying his value or anything. It's just that the journeyman edge rusher has literally 10 times the market that a running back does. And you can understand where that comes from. But when you put the dollars, you know, comparatively speaking, when you match them up dollar for dollar, it's really hard for a team to say, well, I want to, you know, pay a top of market value for a running back when I have to pay a situational edge rusher because you need to hit the quarterback. They're paying. They're throwing the ball 66% of the time on average now.
Yeah.
That position is just far too important. And it's not that it's harder or easier to find that kind of guy, but you look at Carl Loftus in the playoffs for the Chiefs. How many big plays did he make? He's a later first-round pick, which means there's probably, what, eight edge rushers that got drafted before him? Running backs can make an impact. It's just they're able to do it after being drafted in the fifth and sixth round pretty routinely. So you know that you're going to get that. Why are you going to spend more for another position Why would you spend more for that position when you are going to have more impact players that you're going to need to use those premium assets on and those top of market dollars on?
Exactly. Now, it's the combine this week. So let's start with what do you take stock in the combine? Is it running 40s and shuttles, or is it the part we don't see, and that's the interviews?
I think overall for the teams, it's the interviews. And the frustrating thing is, that's the one thing you're not going to hear about. You get the medical questions for the ones that you knew existed answered to some degree, at least for what we can know today. There are players that missed a good chunk of the season last year. You don't know where they are with everything. You'll probably hear some leaked, certainly positive medical news on some players. There's always the story about, one side being aggrieved versus another in the interview process. That's always kind of entertaining. There's a sense of competition as far as the events go. It's a total package thing, and I think people, not that the NFL and media in general don't help this, but there's a certain focus on the combine that I'm willing to bet is not the focus for nearly everybody in attendance in a team capacity. They need the combine. It's not useless. It's just people that think that it's useless think that the only reason they're there is to watch them run the 40. They're there to meet them, to talk to them. They don't get every single opportunity everywhere to get to everybody. Given a choice, and keep in mind, they have very limited windows. There are so many guys they can meet with, and they only have so much time to do it. They have to spread that out strategically, and the combine is a big opportunity for them to sit down and at least, try to feel the player out a little bit. They don't get a ton of time to do that, but it gives them the ability to say, you know what, we're interested in this guy after this. We wanted to talk to him. We'll advance him forward. We didn't get enough from him, but we want to kind of dig in more. Maybe we'll set up an interview with him after, his pro day. Maybe we'll take him out to dinner. Maybe we'll bring him in for a visit, that sort of thing. It's more to advance the timeline of the off season, and teams are militant about the detail and the notes that are going into the players that they're talking to. These are significant investments, and it's also not exactly good odds. It's a great draft if you draft seven times and three of your guys end up being starters within 3 years.
That's right.
That sounds horrible in most cases, right? You're going to fail if you want to define he's not an NFL starter as a failure. It isn't entirely fair, and I'm not sure there's a great way to really determine this, but some teams need a great draft class. They have to start building something, and it's not even going to be something that flips you into a Super Bowl contender in that first year, but they have to know everything, and they have to have guys that fit in every single way possible. And you're doing it in such an artificial environment, they're going to tell you everything that you want to hear. I don't think they necessarily take stock in scripted answers, so they have to come up with questions that are going to put the candidate out of his comfort zone a little bit. And some of them, as we've joked about over the years, go way too far and clearly have no experience interviewing people at all.
Yeah.
It's a really thin line to draw. And more of the necessity of the combine is to get as much as they can out of somebody and then make sure that what you watched on film matches what he does as an individual. I think a lot of the drills are the ones you don't talk about are perhaps more important. I find there's a great connection between overall athleticism and the broad jump, for example. People don't really know what's good or what's not good in a broad jump. The shuttle, probably even more confusing and mysterious. There are great parallel skills to that. The 40, while it's going to show somebody who's really fast and somebody who's really slow, the difference in that middle group probably isn't all that much, except for let's make sure the guy is in shape. Let's make sure he's about what we thought he would be watching him on film. Things like that, it's important, but they're not taking this guy because he ran a 4.43 over the guy who ran a 4.46. That's not going to be the reason why they would ultimately do that in one run, one time. They're going to be around the 4-4 range. They know that they're around the 4-4 range. That's fast. You know, you can kind of measure it as that. But confirmation that, what you see on tape and what you've heard about him or whatever backs that up a bit. What they want, though, is to sit and talk to him about who he is, what he's like as a player, those kinds of things, whatever they can get from a character level from the player. That's ultimately what the combine is really about, but that's not getting people to tune into it. You know, there was a time when the combine was more mystery than anything. You didn't hear anything about it. You saw still images of dudes running around in spandex. Right. You didn't get to watch. To this day, I still don't watch it. I mean, it's as boring a sporting event as there is, if you want to even call it that.
We refer to it as the Underwear Olympics. But it's... See, to me, there is so much tape on players. You can see what kind of football player they are and who knows how to play. Larry Fitzgerald was a 4.63 40 guy. Well, guess what? He knows how to play football. I don't need a combine to show me Larry Fitzgerald knows how to play.
Yeah, when you have guys like that, they can stand out in ways that Fitzgerald in particular, more of, you have to look at it. It's more frustrating because the fans today will find a bevy of 6'4", 6'5", receivers that can run 4'4", 4'3".
Right. Exactly.
That's not normal for a guy that size, as big as Fitzgerald was, even when he was 20 years old.
Yeah,
they didn't run that fast. But at the same time, you look at his agility, which is freakish. A guy half his size was as agile as Fitzgerald was in the open field. And you can see that on tape. His vertical ability, his ability to play above defenders, to go high point a ball, he looked like a high-end safety going for something up in the air. He had just a completely abnormal sense of the ball in the air. You watch those things and you see a Hall of Fame potential candidate.
Yeah.
I don't care if he ran a 4.63. Look at what this guy can do. We don't need him burning guys down the numbers 10 times a game. We need him working to get open. He has the footwork. He has the balance. All of these things for a guy who's half his size, yet he plays like a guy who's twice his size.
That's right.
And he happens to be 6'5". I'm okay with Larry Fitzgerald. You know, this is a top five guy. I don't think 40 times matter to a guy like that. But then you get a guy like Calvin Johnson, who literally showed up not planning on working out, got bored, borrowed cleats from a friend of his, and then ran a 4.29 or whatever it was. That's, you know, that you're talking as a wonder of the world. You know, it's kind of a fun thing to witness. Does that make him a better wide receiver? No. I don't, in my opinion, no. Running straight is the one thing they don't do in football. You know, it's right, in a way the opposite test of everything that they are. But Calvin Johnson was a marvel, and he was a joy to watch if you appreciate athleticism. You see what's normal and what isn't. So there is a sense of you know, spectator enjoyment that goes into it, but it can't be taken at such a ground level. You know, some guys are fast, some guys aren't. You know, that's the difference between third round and sixth round to some level. But the top guys are the ones that you're watching, and most of the time, the dude, there's going to be a guy that runs 4.29. There's usually one. Is he going to be a top 10 pick? Probably not. They usually aren't. There's a lot more that goes into football than just your ability to start on a gun from a three-point stance, a four-point stance, and run straight for 40 yards. You know, there's a lot more that goes into it, and it's only one part of the overall athletic package that a player represents.
Well, some guys run fast, some don't. I'm the latter. All right, so, Neil, appreciate it as always, my friend. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.